ends do not justify the means always. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 10th episode. Oh my gosh, double digits.
That's crazy.
The 10th episode of Stuff We Don't Learn in School. My name is Jenny.
And I'm Victoria.
And today, our topic of discussion is philosophy. Where do we start?
Yeah, philosophy is massive. So today, we're starting off with a couple of ethical dilemma, since ethics, which is also known as like moral philosophy, is just the idea of making a decision using what you believe in to come to a consensus if there is one. And it's almost like Sophie, who wrote this newsletter, said it best: making a decision when all the choices suck. So so we're gonna start off with a couple of situations, and shout out to TED Ed for providing them. And I thought they were super cool. They're great.
Anyways.
So this is the Tylenol dilemma.
Okay.
And you'll see how it relates to Tylenol soon.
Okay.
So a few years ago, you founded a company that sells meatless burgers. And then one day, three unrelated people in a city die after eating your burgers. And then the police say someone injected poison into your burgers at two grocery stores, but you can't tell which products are compromised. So your burgers are immediately moved from the stores, and the headlines are massive. So there's a lot of publicity, which isn't great.
Great.
So you have three options. Uh-huh. You can either do nothing, or you can pull the products from the grocery stores citywide, or pull and destroy the products worldwide. You don't have to recall your products, which is just like pulling them back, because it's not your fault that they're poisoned. Someone else injected poison. Your lawyer recommends to do nothing because it could look like you're admitting that you had some role in this when you really didn't. What do you do? What is your first instinct?
Okay, so somebody injected poison into the burgers at one grocery store?
No, two.
Two?
The three people who died from the store, like from eating your burgers, purchased it at the two stores.
And
but you're not sure if like the poison is in any more of the stores or any of more of your burgers. You don't know.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because if somebody just injected it in the store, I would have said just shut down city.
Yeah.
But, oh, okay. I mean, you have to do worldwide, right? I'm not risking somebody dying because somebody's eating my meatless burger.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's such a juvenile death, number one. Number two, yeah. Just like the thought of somebody dying on my behalf is a little weighty.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would have chosen the citywide one.
Really?
That was my first one. But
because if the poison started at the factory, then that's a different, like, that's where I'm coming from, right?
Right.
Because if somebody, like, say a worker is playing God and, like, putting poison in these burgers at the factory, which is going worldwide,
yeah,
then that's a different story. But if somebody is injecting poison at the grocery store, like locally, then that's city.
Right. And I mean, the video basically took you through like a stakeholder analysis. Like, do nothing, it'll blow over. I mean, it won't be great. You probably will never return to that reputation, but you won't have to lay off that many employees and your investors won't lose that much money.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, your customers might die. So, but citywide is like you lay off more people, but it's generally safer. So it's kind of like the middle ground citywide, mm-hmm. but then pulling all products is the most safe, but the most costly, because that means you have to fire a decent number of people.
Yeah,
and like,
that is true.
It's like a weird thing, but the catch of all of this happened in real life.
With
Tylenol.
Oh, JK.
No, not
Tylenol?
Actually. Yeah. With Johnson & Johnson.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. What happened was somebody, like a criminal or a group, I don't know, added cyanide to Tylenol, which is like death. I mean, if you consume it, you die.
Yeah, no, no, yeah.
So he made the decision to recall all the bottles, which at the time, if you evaluate to our current value of money, was worth $250 million, which is a lot. I don't even know how much that is, but that's a
lot. Respect.
Yeah.
Holy shoot.
And then they found out only three were poisoned, and they were all in the Chicago area. Pulled citywide, then that would have.
But on it, but like, to me, okay, so I.
No.
I do not have a business mindset at all. Like, in any regard, I could never, ever go to business. Like, go into business. So I still stand by that.
No,
decision.
I mean, it was a good decision. From a strategic standpoint, I mean, he regained trust, product sales skyrocketed, and then he became, like, Johnson & Johnson became a pioneer of developing tamper-safe packaging with the FDA, and they started working with the government, and, you know, I mean, at first, critics were like, Johnson & Johnson is definitely screwed, because it was just really costly to recall everything.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned it around into a great marketing and moral choice.
Yeah, exactly. So. Because, I mean, you just think about the demographic that uses Tylenol. Everybody. Every single person. So it's just like risking that. Oh my gosh.
That's such a hard decision, because I think you're forced to choose the option of recall all products. But I also feel like there was some form of serendipity within Johnson & Johnson's like recall. Even though that choice signified that they put like safety above all else and they valued their consumer over whatever the consumer's market value is, which I guess is like infinite or like non-quantifiable. Yeah. It's like, I think
like
this might have been like a perfect combination. I mean, the deaths were terrible, and obviously like it's like a terrible way to die, and it's also like a really sad thing that happened. I don't know if another company did it in a similar set of circumstances, but different, it would have turned out that way. Because in the TED Ed video, the last point they made was this some ethical choice or a good marketing ploy? And I didn't understand that, but like what happened after this was like criminals started doing the same thing to other products. So it was kind of like a series type thing. It was never that extreme or that harmful as the Johnson & Johnson Tylenol incident, but it started kind of like happening again. This is a case study that a lot of business majors, a lot of schools use. I think it highlights the two seemingly diametrically opposed concepts of, you know, social responsibility and making profit, because a lot of the times the two are not
at odds with each other.
Yep.
Yeah, they don't exactly, one decision doesn't exactly produce both.
Yeah.
Both ethics and profits, unfortunately.
It's interesting because, like, you know, what do you do? Because you want to make money, maybe for the purpose of making money, but you also want to keep your workers afloat. If I were in the position of, like, the meat burger thing, I don't know if I would be able to lay off that many workers just to make sure. But also, like, you wouldn't know how widespread it was.
Wait, why are you laying off workers?
Well, because people are buying less. You just need less people to produce. And if people buy less, then people get, like, lose their jobs. Maybe you could argue the impact of that could be greater than more people dying. This is just very unrelated to the meatless burgers, but that was the thing, and I could be misconstruing history because I'm not great at it. We were arguing about, like, Britain and America, if America was justified to leave that. And one of the points that somebody brought up was the Boston Massacre and how the British unleashed, like, violence and killed American civilians when it wasn't necessary. But then the counterargument was, well, America dumped all this tea and then crashed that one company that controlled all the tea, which resulted in, like, economic devastation and obviously lives versus economy, like, lives are greater. Yeah. But then you think about how many people got laid off and probably died as a result of that, and their families suffered as a result of that.
It's long-term versus immediate.
Right, exactly. And it's just an interesting thing, and also I think one thing I want to do when I'm older that relates to this is enter the business world for a little bit. And I think the cool thing is our generation, Generation Z, and also the generation before us, mm-hmm. like, we care more about social and corporate responsibility and what corporations are doing, like who's donating to what organizations, who's supporting what causes for businesses. And though it can become performative at times, I think this kind of shift in allowing both ethics and profit to coexist with each other in like the capitalistic yeah. world we live in is cool. I mean, it's something new.
It's definitely, I feel like business ethics or just like bioethics, business ethics, I feel like they're relatively new whenever you talk about, you know, the history of education and what topics we focus on, you know, like classes in bioethics or classes in business ethics, because we're kind of delving into the nuances of each of these areas of studies a little bit more. You know, we've been exposed to them a little bit more, especially in the modern world.
And also,
it's really interesting.
I think the reason why ethics, I mean, ethics have always been a thing. I mean, philosophy is so ancient.
That's
but,
true.
But now ethics is like more in the context, I think, of technology. So like we're reinventing these systems to be integrated with like humans and robots or algorithms and people. So what is our responsibility in that? And how do we design these worlds and these places that like foster humanity rather than, you know, strip us into people who work, people who are under the control of companies who want our attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that you brought that up, because I was listening to this podcast that Andrew Yang hosts, and he invited Tristan Harris. So Tristan Harris is this design ethicist at Google, or he once worked at Google. And he was in The Social Dilemma, which I think I've talked about on here before. But, I mean, it's a cool documentary that talks about everything we know about technology and how all of these apps are wired to get our attention. Like, that's the metric for success.
Mm-hmm.
And Tristan was talking about how he ran into this sort of crossroads where he had this vision for social impact. But the tech world had a similar vision, but then they justified kind of wrong behavior, and they conflated the idea of making the world a better place with how much time you spend on your phone. For context, Tristan Harris founded Apture, which was acquired by parts by Google. But mm-hmm. the purpose of Apture, which ironically, and I'm not trying to compare this because I think this would be like very funny, but like it's kind of similar to our goal, where the idea is to, it's very romantic, it's just to strengthen democracy and allow people to seek knowledge
mm-hmm.
for the sake of seeking knowledge and just be well informed and have information accessible and ready to the masses.
Yes.
So what Apture did was, let's say you're reading the Washington Post, and the Washington Post is talking about climate change. So Apture is, I'm not sure if it's like a web extension or something like that, but it was some sort of program that allows you to like click on climate change, and then beside it, you'll see a compilation of multimedia sources talking about climate change.
Oh.
Whether it was like, I don't know, a video about climate change from mm-hmm. NPR, or like a short form, like op-ed or
just
something
like
that. Like
a bunch of different other media sources.
Right. To like,
yes. To compare to and get your best.
Right. And yeah. also like, yeah, gauge everyone's viewpoints and stuff rather than having to leave the article, research more. Like, it was just trying to simplify kind of how we process information, which is really cool.
It's amazing.
And yeah. then another cool example that Tristan brought up was, like, a lot of articles talk about this, what Kamala Harris said or Vice President-elect Kamala Harris said mm-hmm. and different policy proposals they have and different rhetoric they use during the debates. What Apture would do is you'd be hovering over maybe your local congresswoman or vice president-elect or whoever it was, and then it provides you their voting record on the side.
Oh.
And kind of their speeches on the floor, which is cool, because, like, I'm not that much of a politics buff, history buff.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm not going to look up my vote, like, my person's voting record.
No.
So that just makes things much...
It's just, like, convenience.
Right.
The major benefit, other than, you know, globalization for technology is, well, okay. The two major benefits of technology are globalization, obviously, and honestly, convenience.
Yeah.
Access to information like that.
And the goal of Apture, like Tristan said, was like to be very socially driven. Mm-hmm. The idea is to increase accountability, transparency, like understanding.
Yes.
And this was like the early 2000s, so when the dot-com bubble kind of like happened, and the future of news was like uncertain. We didn't know what news would look like, how it'd be consumed, what the next generation would want. So they had to fight for every single publisher, whether it was The Economist. And then what they ran into was all of these publishers just asked the question, is this increasing the number of minutes a user spends on my website?
Mm.
And it's like the same thing with Facebook. Facebook is like, we want to connect the world. Okay, that's a very fair mission. Jenny knows personally that I love that mission. I think it's great. But how are they doing that? They're measuring it by how much people spend on Facebook. And when you're spending time on Facebook, you're not spending time with real people and connections. It's really easy to conflate the two. And then he basically was talking about, like, he realized a couple years in, he couldn't keep doing it. He was telling his actual team this message. And then when he was pitching it to the publishers and the investors, he was telling them another message. And he was like, it's so subtle, but it just couldn't exist. And then what happened was sent out this like 100-page long slide of just ethics and tech. And we're responsible for creating these colorful buttons and everything. Like, why? Like, what? Like, for what? Like, what is our end goal? Like, are we trying to destroy humanity? Like, what is our purpose? And
oh,
I thought it was a really cool example of trying to rechange the playing field and the game and the end goals of corporations and businesses. And I think he's a good example of being conscious about humanity while trying to make progress and trying to use tech for all of these things.
Yeah, I wouldn't have... You said he's a design ethicist?
Yeah.
That, like, again, I didn't know there was such thing, you know? Yep. Like, whenever you think of graphic design, you don't think of the philosophical repercussions of it. You don't think of, really, the big picture until you're, I guess, put in that position as he was. And so whenever he asks these questions, it makes me think, this is cheesy, but there is, like, a bigger meaning behind everything, you know? And everything really ties in because... Whenever you think of Google's design, right, you think of happy and go lucky. And but whenever you put it like that, like what really is the point of doing such things, you know?
And the fact that there are people in the tech world who are just addressing these questions that probably are hard to address. Like, I don't know. There's probably no answer.
As there is usually no answer for ethical questions.
Yeah. Exactly. And then the second dilemma is about self-driving cars, which is pretty relevant because, I mean, those are a thing. And also, we live in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh has a lot of companies like Argo AI. I mean, we have, I think, Uber and Tesla. We have a lot of development in that area. And this scenario is, let's say you're driving and you're boxed in. So around you on the highway, like, there are cars and people.
Mm-hmm.
And a truck is in front of you and a large heavy object falls towards you. What do you do? Do you swerve right towards a motorcycle where somebody else is riding it so you prioritize your safety over others? Do you keep driving and get hit by the heavy object and prioritize other safeties over yours? Or do you go the middle ground and hit the SUV, which has decent protection? I mean, it's a self-driving car, so it's like if you were a programmer, what would you?
So on one side is the motorcycle and the other is the SUV.
Or do you just keep going?
Ooh. I think the SUV, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that too. Yeah, the motorcycle, yeah, that person's not going to survive.
Yeah, no. So, and then, okay, so chances of survival if you hit the motorcycle, like, essentially zero.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Chances of survival of a heavy object going directly at your windshield in front of you. You know, there's a chance, but not, yeah. Chances of survival of you hitting the rear end of an SUV.
Yeah, like, probably, maybe.
I mean, you know, minimal damage, I feel like.
Yeah, and I thought the answer was pretty obvious. I mean, it seems like we both have the same thing, mm-hmm. but the interesting thing was, if this is real life, I would probably swerve to the SUV.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't matter because you were making the decision on the fly. But the problem with, like, self-driving cars is these are, like, premeditated deaths. Because they're... Because, I mean, someone has to program it, right? So it's like, what do you do with that? Who would want to buy a car that prioritizes other safeties over... I wouldn't.
I mean, but, like, I feel like that's not something that... It's not... There are so many products out there, especially like vehicle mm-hmm. products, where just, yeah, no, just products in general, where there are so many nuances within that product that we don't know of until a situation arises where, you know, you realize that your self-driving car is now crashing into an SUV and not the motorcycle.
These are questions that are being addressed now, and while self-driving cars are like cool and they help a lot, I mean, they reduce a lot of human-made errors. What if in those situations you only target SUVs? Then it's like anybody who drives an SUV, they don't have control. I mean, it just becomes this giant systematic problem. Because then, like, what if you take into account who's in the seat for all of those? Like, whether it's someone old or young, like, what do you do? Because, like, no option is good. Because I wouldn't want to buy a car that has decisions that help other people over me. Like, I want to survive. Like,
yeah.
Well, I'm not paying $100,000, like, $10,000, whatever.
For
like.
Me to just get straight smacked in the head with a heavy object. Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's really just, like Sophie said, picking the best choice out of the worst options.
Yeah. The problem is this won't be an individual decision. So, like, it's like once you program it, it will be for all cars. So the questions that were brought up in the TED Ed video is like, will certain types of cars or certain people, certain victims be targeted more because...
Just like demographically.
Right, because it's more safe at the SUV. It matters less, quote unquote, if they die because... They have less life to live.
Wow.
Yeah. And who should be making these decisions? Like the government, these corporations.
I feel like if whenever it comes to like demographics and if you're choosing somebody's life over another based on demographics, that's where it becomes a no-no. You know, but if you're going solely based on chance of life, you know, like hitting a motorcycle versus an SUV. I feel like the SUV would be, like, a fairly obvious choice.
Yeah, but then I wouldn't want to buy an SUV. Like, screw that. I'm riding a motorcycle all the while. Like, I'll learn how to...
scoot. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just... I don't know. Like, this one is particularly unsatisfying because we don't know the answer. Like, it's not like I can pull up a Tylenol-type example. Like, there's just none.
Yeah. There's no ending.
Yeah. I mean, we've covered data governance. And it just relates to, like, racist algorithms.
Yeah.
Also, we talked about privacy, too, earlier. It's the idea of, like, what's the expense of privacy? Like, what are we doing it for? Like, sometimes sharing our healthcare data could be great for...
Research.
Right. But, you know, where's the line?
Yeah. Who can access that data? Who utilizes it?
You know,
like, how private is your data?
And I think we all do this, but it was nice to hear conceptualized. But there are four different tests generally that are used if you're not sure what decision to make. there's the utilitarian test, which if you like shorten it, it's just called util. Mm-hmm. And it's just the philosophy where you maximize good in the end. So
yeah, so no, with whatever means you can, essentially. Yeah.
There's the family test. How would you feel explaining your this, whatever you do to your family? There's the newspaper test. How would you feel reading it on the cover of the New York Times? Mm-hmm. There's the mentor test. So someone you admire, what would they do? It's kind of like when people say, what would Jesus do? Like, it's like same thing. So those are four different types of tests, which I think are interesting because I
never thought of the last three. You know, I've heard of utilitarianism, yeah. But the different perspectives, family, outsider, mentor.
Which one do you think would force you to make the best decision? Like, I don't think it'd be util for me.
No, never util. Are you kidding me? No, here's an ethical dilemma for you for utilitarian. You are an experienced transplant surgeon with 5 dying patients, all of whom are desperately in need of organs. One needs a heart, while others need liver, stomach, kidney, and spinal cord, respectively. What makes the case study difficult is that the patients all have the same rare blood type. By accident, you find out that within the city there is a healthy man with the required blood type. If you kill him and transfer his organs to the dying patient, you would be able to save all 5 patients. However, it's very likely that they will die if you do not transfer his organs. What do you do? So the utilitarian would kill him in order to maximize 5 lives. But I feel like any relatively moral human would not kill a healthy man who didn't deserve it.
Yeah, that's like deontology, like the principle and the actual action that you take to get there matters more than the end result. I would say, like, in this scenario, like, let the man live. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
The ends do not justify the means always. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. And that's ethics for you. Everything is gray, and it's just case by case.
Yeah, it is case by case. Like, I would say generally, I probably lean more toward the means matter more than the ends. I think I like to be very, like, principle-oriented. Like, I don't really care what the end result is as long as I show. Then that usually is kind of, like, my way to go. But also, I can imagine there are times when I, like, you too. I would say for me, the mentor test would probably make me make the best decision. Like, no, I don't, like, the family, okay. I mean, they still love me for me. Like, they don't have an option.
Aww,
the newspaper.
Newspaper is, like, media is so freaking skewed.
Like,
always.
Who cares?
Yeah.
The mentor test, though.
The mentor test.
Yeah, that's rough.
It do what somebody you admire would do. That would definitely make me choose the right decision. For sure. I think that's honestly how I live my day-to-day.
Really?
Ethical. Yeah. I always I'm thinking, like, what would she do? What would they do?
I don't think I have a mentor person I can even, like, think of. Like, I say mentor, but I don't even know who that would be.
No, or just somebody whose ethics or just moral life decisions you admire.
Maybe my mentor or my parental units.
Yeah.
That's kind of skewed because that merges the family test with the mentor test. But like, I don't know. I actually don't know.
Well, okay, for me, okay, so for day-to-day living and, like, my future, I think that's whenever I think of, like, my mentors. Because typically, you know, I don't run into ethical dilemmas all too often. Thank God. But I think about my mentors, like, a lot. Mentors, people who I admire.
And I think that's the thing with religion. My parents would always explain to me, I don't know how religious I am. I don't really think I am. Like, if you evaluate objectively, I don't think you would classify me
as feel
religious.
Like, I'm agnostic.
Yeah. But my parents are. And they always say the reason why they converted to Christianity because China isn't...
It's not religious.
Yeah. They believed in and thought these morals imposed by the Bible, these standards were correct and something they wanted to follow by. So religion is the safety net when there's no direction. And that's like for everyone. I mean, I think that's the appeal because it's something bigger and it's when you're lost, you have something to turn to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, good on them. I just...
yeah, I don't know. You said like you don't face a lot of ethical dilemmas, but I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of things are.
Really?
I wrote down some examples. Your friend asks if a dress looks good, if their essay looks good. What do you say?
Like white lies.
Yeah, like what do you say? Like, especially like with college essays, like you're in the middle of it right now. Like,
Well, thankfully, I have surrounded myself with fairly well-written, well-spoken, and very smart people. So, you know, usually I don't lie. Sometimes there will come a time where, you know, if somebody sends me a photo of themselves, like that they want to post on Instagram, right? Yeah. And they're like, should I post this? I'm like, yeah, go for it. Oh my gosh, you look amazing. Whenever it is like not the best photo of them.
I read this interesting article. It's like, you can be ends-based, you can be rules-based, or you can be care-based.
Aww.
And I think that's a good way to kind of put it.
Yeah. Because see, I don't think philosophy is weird, right? I mean, we all know this. But I think the issue with so many philosophers is that they try to make a set of rules. I mean, this is the issue with like law and the justice system and really anything that governs anything else, is that they're trying to box up life in a few short rules. And no matter how broad the rules may be, it will never encompass all of life's situations. So I think the best way to kind of approach ethics and philosophy is to use everything, you know, utilitarianism, moralism, family mentor, newspaper, just everything.
But that's easier said than done.
Okay, no, it is. Of course it's easier said than done. Come on, it's life. Like, everything is easier said than done.
I feel like that's a non-answer, though, because if you approach life with that mindset, however true and accurate that may be, I mean, life just gets very tiring.
Well, it's like, I mean,
it's the same thing with reading. I'm reading these books and I'm annotating them.
Mm.
And that might be the best way to read because you actually maximize what you get out of it, but
you're not reading for fun.
Yeah, for the sake of it. So yeah, it's also nothing.
I mean, this is true because
what do you do?
If you overanalyze every single decision you make in life, I think there are points in time where you can do a little white lie without internalizing, like, is this utilitarian of me, you know? But I think whenever it comes to decisions that truly impact a great number of people's lives or your own, if it's, you know, an important enough decision, that's where you kind of consider all of these different ethical pathways.
Yeah. This is like very like, oh, ethics. And Sophie writes it in the newsletter, but it's everywhere. I mean, especially in the legal.
Yeah.
Like area like abortion or gun control. Like, I mean, all of it deals what's the right decision. If there is any, and there usually isn't. And I think the way to go, and what I think might be most helpful, at least for me in this stage that I can say, is like surrounding yourself with people you trust to make these decisions, not for you, but to get their input. So like what I'll do often is like I'll call up people and I'll ask them, and it doesn't mean I'll listen to them, but I trust them so that I will take, you know, their thing into consideration. It's kind of like taking in util, Dion.
Yeah, because everybody just like to guide you.
Yeah,
essentially.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, that's so Buddhist of us. Because no, we're reading this book, right? In AP literature, it's called Siddhartha, and it's about Buddhism. And the way you achieve nirvana is through self exploration of the self.
Yeah.
That's redundant. But you get what I mean. Like, you can't, nobody can impose wisdom upon you. Rather, they can guide you on your pathway. You know?
Right. Exactly. And on that note, make sure to follow our Instagram at Stuff We Don't Learn in School and sign up for the newsletter. So the ending quote is by Potter Stewart. I did think of Harry Potter when I saw this quote. But he is an American lawyer and judge who served as an associate justice of the United States Supreme Court from 1958 to 1981. Yeah, that's a long time. Mm-hmm. During his time, he made contributions to criminal justice reform and civil rights. And his quote is, "Ethics is knowing the difference between what you have a right to do and what is right to do."
As always, Stuff We Don't Learn in School would not be possible without our team. Thank you to Sophie Liu for writing the newsletter, Victoria Wren for the resource, Emma Scott for the digital content, and Gloria Wong for the graphic design.